You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. I am C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction. Today I'm speaking with Charlene Ball about Dark Lady, which explores the life of Emilia Bassano Lanier, including her relationship with William Shakespeare. Scholars disagree over whether Emilia was Shakespeare's model for the Dark Lady of his sonnets, but either way, she was not only the poet's lover. Emilia wrote remarkable poetry of her own. When we first meet her, she is very young. October, 1576. "No, I won't go," Emilia shouted, kicking at the rushes on the floor. "Stop that and come here, Emilia." Her mother held out her arms. Emilia stomped around the room, shouting, "No, no, stomp, stomp, no, 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 no." "Stop," implored her mother. The little girl stood teetering as her mother began to cough. She stood on one foot, then slowly lowered the other to the floor. "Stop coughing, Mama." Her mother pressed her handkerchief to her mouth, swallowing hard, then sprang up and grabbed her daughter by the shoulders. "You are going to the Countess of Kent, and that's all there is to it." Emilia went limp and began to wail as her mother held her tight. "Don't cry, darling. Please don't cry." They clung to each other, sobbing. When they pulled apart, her mother sat on the stool and lifted her daughter onto her lap. She wiped Emilia's cheeks with her apron and ran her hands over the little girl's tangled curls. She smoothed the hair back from her small forehead and kissed it. "You know I don't want you to go." "Then I'll stay," Emilia said, snuggling close to her mother. "No, you must go. You are 7 years old now and of an age to be fostered. The Countess has offered of her goodness to take you into her service and have you educated as a gentlewoman. It is a very great honor and an opportunity for you." Her mother drew a deep breath. "If I could give you all you need, I would never, ever let you go. But I can't. So yes, I want you to go." Emilia swallowed and nodded. Her mother tightened her arms. "Go and show the Countess how we musician folk can strut and spout Latin with the best of them." And now, please join me in welcoming Charlene Ball. Hi, Charlene. I look forward to talking with you today.
Hi, Carolyn. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Tell us about your life before Dark Lady. You're a professor of English literature, especially Renaissance literature, as well as a poet and a playwright. How did that all come about?
I taught English for many years at colleges and universities in North Carolina and Georgia. I have a BA from Wake Forest. I majored in English, and an MA from the University of North Carolina in Greensboro. And that's where I really started reading about the Elizabethan drama and loving it. Did my thesis on Christopher Marlowe. And I got a PhD in comparative literature focused on Renaissance drama. And then I began teaching. And ever since, between 1997 and 2009, I was the administrator in the Women's Studies Institute at Georgia State University. It's now called the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies. And so I taught women's studies and did administer the program. So that's kind of my academic background. And I've always loved the Elizabethan Renaissance age and have always been writing, really. I've been writing most of my life.
So have you been writing fiction most of your life, or how did you transition from academic writing into fiction?
I've always loved writing fiction. That's really my first love with writing. I did some academic articles and then very happily went back to writing fiction. I wrote two unpublished novels back in the 70s and 80s, and I wrote some plays, which one got a very nice staged reading, the one about Christopher Marlowe that has Shakespeare and Amelia as characters. And then I wrote a play about Shakespeare and Amelia. But that's very different from my novel.
So what drew you to Amelia and her story in particular?
I heard a lecture in the late 1970s when I was in graduate school by historian A.L. Ralph, who was expounding his theory that Amelia Lanier was the dark lady of Shakespeare's sonnets. And I was intrigued because the idea that she had been discovered, first of all, because most English literature people said, oh, it's not possible to know who this woman was. And so Ralph said, yes, he had discovered her doing research on the astrologer, Simon Forman. Amelia was one of Simon Forman's clients. And I was so excited to find out that she might have been involved with Shakespeare, and that she was a writer in her own right, a poet in her own right, and that she was an early feminist. She published a book in 1611, which was a book of religious poetry, which makes strong arguments for women's equality.
That's great. Now, you mentioned that your play about Amelia and Shakespeare was very different. Did you use that as a basis for a novel, or did you really start from scratch?
I started from scratch. The play was written decades ago, and I see Amelia very differently now. I didn't follow the facts of her life very carefully in the play, and so she doesn't come across at all in the play the way I see her now.
So let's talk about her then. I mean, she's far from the only character in this wonderful book, but she's definitely its center. It's her novel, her focus. She has a very interesting history. How did she end up in England, for starters?
Well, she was born in England. She was born in Bishopsgate. See, her family, the Bassanos, were musicians for the Doge of Venice. And I'll say more about their background in a minute. But for at least a couple of generations, they had been in a small town near Venice called Bassano del Grappa, which is still there, by the way. And then they moved to Venice and were musicians for the Doge, who was the ruler of Venice. And then Henry VIII invited the five Bassano brothers to London to be court musicians. They had a consort like a band of wind instruments, and they were known as musicians and instrument makers. So they came to London, and one of the five brothers, the youngest, was Amelia's father. He married an English woman named Margaret Johnson, who might have also been of an English family of musicians, but Robert Johnson, who is a well-known Renaissance musician, might be related to Amelia also. So Amelia was born in London. Her father died when she was seven, and then she and her mother were alone, and so the book tells about how she came to be fostered by the Countess of Kent, Lady Susan. But more about Amelia's background, I guess you want me to say a little more about the Marano aspect, I guess. She actually may have been from a family of conversos, or secret Jews. See, the Jews were driven out of Spain by Ferdinand and Isabella, and they scattered. Some went to North Africa, some went to Italy, some went up into Europe. And so the theory is, it's not proven, but it's believed by many scholars that the Bassanos came from a family of converted Jews, and they converted in order to escape persecution and then found out that wasn't going to help them, really. So they left Spain, and then and in Italy they enjoyed a great amount of freedom. But then when they came to England, you know, they lived as English people, as Protestants, and went to the English church. It's believed that they may be Jews because of connections they have with known Jewish musicians like the Lupo family and others that they are married into. And you see, the theory was that there were no Jews in England, that they were expelled in 1290 by King Edward I, but there were always Jews in England to a certain extent. You know, there was the Queen's physician, Dr. Rodrigo Lopez. There was another a well-known family named the Añez or Ames family, and they were there. They were just either hidden or they passed as Christians.
Yeah, and of course it was quite common in Elizabethan England, not only for Jews to pass as Christians, but for one type of Christian to pass as another type of Christian, because it was very, you know, there was this law that you had to be Protestant. And although Elizabeth herself didn't burn people to the same degree as her sister, the penalties for being caught not being of the approved sub-faith were extremely severe.
It could have been very confusing, especially during Henry VIII's reign, because Henry would change his mind from decade to decade. And so in one decade, you were not allowed to read the Tyndale, the Protestant translations of the Bible. Another decade, they were put in the churches and were supposed to be read from the pulpit. So there's a suspicion that Shakespeare's father was a secret Catholic. And so that theory is very interesting.
That is interesting. I hadn't heard that one. I have heard about Dr. Rodriguez Lopez and the Añez family, because another author that I interviewed a couple of years ago, Anne Swinfen, has an entire series called The Chronicles of Cristobal Alvarez. And Cristobal is a Marano living in England. He's a doctor.
I want to read those.
You would love them, because actually Cristobal is Kit, and his, in quotation marks, original name is Katerina.
Ah, okay. I must look that up. What's your name? Stin?
Anne Swinfen. I'll give you the references after we finish.
Okay, great.
What does it mean for Amelia to be the daughter of a musician, even a court musician? How does that affect her standing and her opportunities in Elizabethan London?
Okay, to begin with, the court musicians were considered like minor gentry. That is, they were respectable people, but they were not well-to-do. So many of her relatives did manage to make a good bit of money and bought houses outside the city and were pretty prosperous. Her father died with debt, so she was in a pretty bad state after her father died, and that's why her mother sends her away to be fostered by Lady Susan, who has made the offer, because she believes in education for women. As a woman, Amelia could not be a court musician. She could not be a member of the consort. So I show that as something that is a major obstacle for her, because she is talented and she plays the flute and the keyboards. And if she had been a boy, she could have done that. But that was closed to her. There were women at court who were entertainers, but there were no professional musicians that I know of. And there were even women who appeared on the stage, but they were really special cases, and they were not, in general, they were not the actors. Women's roles were played by men and boys. So Amelia didn't have the same kind of opportunities open to her that that her father and a brother of hers would have had. So the choices she makes are based on the limitations that she knows as a woman.
But that's interesting, though. But her social standing is such that she's not wildly out of place at the Countess of Kent's estate.
She's not wildly out of place, but she's like, I kind of portray her as a little waiting, a little, you know, serving girl, but not on the lower level. Because, you know, at this time, people of one higher status were served by the people of the next lowest status, and they were served by the people of the next status. And so only really, you know, the only really lower class people who did things like empty chamber pots and clean things out, they were the lower class people. But ladies in waiting were often titled themselves. So Amelia is among titled people and children of titled people, even though she herself doesn't come from that kind of family. And that causes her a lot of, causes her some distress, because she can see daily about how she doesn't have what the other girls around her have. Aunt Margaret Carey, for example, who has nice dresses, and Amelia has hand-me-downs.
Yeah, that would be difficult. I mean, that's always difficult. It still exists in its modern form, and it's difficult now for the people who have to watch it. And yet this move of hers to live with the Countess of Kent, and this is her route to an education, and it's really one of the more significant relationships of her life, as I understand it.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so Lady Susan is enormously influential to her, and also Lady Susan's mother, who was a famous Marian exile. That is, she left England when Queen Mary came to the throne because she was such a committed Protestant. So Lady Susan's parents fled the country during Mary's reign because they were under, right before they were caught up and arrested by Cardinal Reginald Gardiner, and Stephen Gardiner, excuse me. And so they were in exile until Mary died and Elizabeth came to the throne. So the Duchess of Suffolk really fascinates me too. That's Lady Susan's mother. I'd love to write something about her sometime.
Oh, that would be great. I'd love to read that. And what takes Amelia away from Lady Susan's house?
Lady Susan gets married. She's a young widow. Her first husband died when she was only 19. And after Amelia has stayed there for a number of years, from the time she's 7 until the time she's around 13, Lady Susan marries again, and she goes with her husband, who is not mentioned in the story, but his name is Sir John Wingfield, and he was a military person. And so they went to the Low Countries. And so the household was broken up, and Amelia had to go back to her mother's house. And her mother's ill, her mother has consumption. So from being at court and having daily contact with titled people, she has to go back and be a caretaker to her ailing mother.
This would be a good time to talk a little bit about Amelia's character, her personality. How do you see her, and how does she react to this change in her fortunes?
I see her as resilient, maybe more resilient than she realizes, as being envious to a certain extent of people more fortunate than herself, and having a great deal of desire and yearning to be, one, for education, and to be where things are happening. At court is where things are being discussed and decisions are made, and she loves being in the middle of all that and having access to important people. So you could say that there's a kind of enviousness in her, and at the same time, it's also just her great appetite for life, excitement, knowledge, she doesn't like dullness. However, on the other hand, she is enormously resilient and capable, and staying with her mother gives her another kind of scope to develop her ability, her survival skills, her practicality and her frugality are created there. So she develops a strong character and a resilience and a reliance upon herself during those teen years.
And she's hanging around with her cousins, basically, right, who are musicians. She's, mm-hmm. Although she can't be mm-hmm. a professional musician, she does sometimes play with them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I allowed her to play theirs. What I'm imagining is that the cousins are apprentices to the musicians who are their fathers and uncles, and they also are apprenticed as instrument makers, but they also go out and play on the side, such as like, you know, that they might like have a gig at somebody's private house or a party at Gray's Inn, which is where a law student studied. And so that's what I'm picturing them doing here. Just a little extra money on the side going out to play, and that they allowed Amelia to play with them, even though this is not official.
So while she is, this is still fairly early in the book, so we don't go too far because mm-hmm. we don't want to give too many plot spoilers away, although for a historical character, it's not quite as compelling as a problem as it is with an entirely made-up story, but because people can always mm-hmm. go and do their research and find out. But in any case, mm-hmm. She's at one of these gatherings with her cousins as a musician when all of a sudden her life takes a really unexpected and unwelcome turn. Mm-hmm. What happens to her? Can you explain and what this means for her in the context of Elizabethan England?
She meets a young man who she had met him previously at court, and he tried to be aggressive then. And now she meets him again. He acts contrite, and so he invites her to meet him in a garden after dark, and warning signs would be going off in everybody in every direction. But Amelia is just curious and eager for experience. So she meets him, and it's terrible because she gets raped. And then she later finds she's pregnant, but then loses the fetus. So she is now that this is known among her family, it's not quite the way it would have been during Victorian times. You know, there was a lot of leeway for young women, especially in her class and below, but still, she doesn't want what is going to have to happen. That is, the family will find someone for her to marry, and she'll be submerged into that. She won't be considered at all material for a more elevated kind of marriage. So it's an enormous event in terms of what her prospects for life are.
And she, and she also loses her mother at around this time. And I apologize because I mm-hmm. don't remember the exact sequence, whether she loses her mother and then she runs into Lord Hunsdon or mm-hmm. vice versa. But she's 16 and she's going through these enormous changes.
She meets Lord Hunsdon at another event, and he seems almost like a savior because he just seemed to burst on the scene with so much energy, and he takes her home, and he offers help and material help to her and her mother. He gets Dr. Lopez to come and take care of her mother, and then her mother dies, and she's 18 by then. And so when Hunsdon indicates that he is interested in her now that she's grown up, even though he is many years older than she is, she considers and finally accepts him as a lover, and so she becomes his paramour.
And fill us in a bit on, first off, who is Lord Hunsdon?
Lord Hunsdon is Henry Carey, the first cousin of Queen Elizabeth. He's the son of her sister Mary Carey, who was the main character in The Other Boleyn Girl, if you remember that. And he is the Lord Chamberlain. That's his position. He's also a head of military operations in the north. And so he goes to Berwick upon Tweed to fight against the northern uprising, because Queen Elizabeth's reign did not bring peace and contentment to everyone, and there were a number of unconverted Catholics in the north, many of them quite powerful, who did not like Protestantism being imposed upon the country. So there were uprisings. There was something called the Pilgrimage of Grace, and then there was another northern uprising. Lord Hunsdon was sent up there to quell that, which he did. So he's a military person, and yet he is, and he's very devoted to the Queen. And so I picture him as a kind of a rough and ready soldier with yet a great deal of cultivation. He becomes a patron of theater companies, including Shakespeare's theater company, later the Lord Chamberlain's Men.
Yes, I hadn't realized that initially, but yes, he does. And he's considerably older than
He's 45 years older than she is, which seems quite shocking to people nowadays, although maybe not. But there is a huge gap in their ages.
And yet she has a certain affection for him, and I think probably because he's so kind to her, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, at first I thought I wasn't going to like him, but then the more I wrote about him, the more I realized that it was more complex than that. And Amelia does develop a great deal of affection for him. He's kind to her. He's protective. He is as she puts it, she says he's merry and kind, and we get along well. And so she said she would marry him if she could, but she can't because, of course, he's already married.
And, of course, I mean, he may love his wife or he may be kind to his wife mm-hmm. as well, but he probably didn't marry his wife for love. So,
right.
In that sense, too, I mean, attitudes were different towards mm-hmm. marriage and love than they are now.
Yes, most marriages were arranged in all levels of society. And yet a lot of people who were married for political purposes ended up loving their spouses.
Mm-hmm.
And having a great deal of affection for them.
So, and what does Amelia mean to him, do you think?
I think he has a kind of paternal feeling for her. And that, of course, I'm very aware of the, you know, the modern eyes see such a thing as very, you know, look askance at that, because there is a kind of... you know, people might think incest is implied. I see him as paternalistic, though. Not paternalistic, but paternal, father-like, a friend to her. I think he sees himself as a friend and a helper. And I think she's grateful for him, and yet she ends up deceiving him, for which she feels guilty.
Which brings us to William Shakespeare, whom Amelia also meets in this period. Describe your Shakespeare. What makes him unique?
I think I had a great deal of fun writing Shakespeare, I have to admit. And I think what makes him unique in my book is that I don't put him on a pedestal. I don't think of him as the great god of English literature. I think of him as an enormously talented, brilliant, clever, fun person. And I try to bring out the fun aspect of him, the wit and the cleverness and the liveliness and the energy and the drive and ambition, too. And also his attitude toward women was not entirely as we might have wished. You know, he left his wife, you know, and was supposed to have had at least, you know, several relationships outside of marriage. Besides Amelia, if she was the Dark Lady of the Sonnets, and then there were supposed to be others. There were anecdotes told about him meeting with, for example, one about him meeting with a citizen's wife who went up to Burbage after a performance of Richard III and said that she wanted him to come to her house and say that it was Richard III. So Shakespeare supposedly overheard them, and so he went to her house. And so he was let in, and then later when Richard Burbage, he's the actor who was the main actor of Shakespeare's acting company, Burbage shows up and says that Richard III is there, and Shakespeare sends back word that William the Conqueror came before Richard III. So
that's a good line. You have to give him credit.
Yes, it's a good line. Yes, and it's told by a contemporary, so it could be true.
And he left his wife with three kids, as I recall. Which
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
He left his wife with three kids, so I'd be amazed if she ever let him back in the door.
Oh, I know. But they may have had to get married because they got married when he was 19 and she was 26. And 6 months later, their first child was born. And then about a year later, the twins were born. So and then shortly after that, we don't hear any more about Shakespeare in Stratford. And about 7 years later, we hear of him in London.
Doesn't seem to have learned his lesson, though.
Well,
I guess indeed. Nobody else can marry him. I guess that's why.
Marrying that young also closed off some opportunities to him, because in my book, I have him say that his father would have tried to send him to a university, but in those days, only unmarried people could go to university.
Right. So, and this is fairly early in his career when he meets Emilia, and the sonnets are written fairly early on. Mm-hmm. So he's sort of in the Romeo and Juliet period, so the Shakespeare in Love period.
Right? Yeah, that's right. He's just getting started. And so I have him talk about some of his earlier plays. You know, he wrote Taming of the Shrew fairly early, and that was based on another existing play called The Taming of a Shrew. And he wrote Titus Andronicus pretty early. That may have been his first play. Or, Two Gentlemen of Verona. And then, Romeo and Juliet was early also. I guess maybe his first really great play. And then there were the history plays. Probably the Henry VI plays were, they were before the later ones, before the Henry V and those.
Well, that explains a lot about Titus Andronicus. It's probably the one he shouldn't have published,
Oh, I know. It was awful. It has some good parts in it, but mainly it's just, revolting.
So what draws Shakespeare to Emilia, and what draws Emilia to him?
What draws Emilia to him? A spark of life, wit, intelligence, banter, charm. He's very charming. I try to portray him as somebody who is like Puck, somebody who's almost magical at the very beginning. And he just enchants her. And I think he sees something like that in her. He sees a wit that can match his in her. And he sees not only beauty, because I'm thinking of her as not so much conventionally beautiful as having an air about her, just having this allure that can be dangerous to her, and yet it can serve her well, and it can be damaging to her too.
Yeah, you conveyed that really well. I think I also see her not necessarily as conventionally beautiful, but one of these very vivacious women, so that you don't even notice whether they're beautiful or not. Mm-hmm. They just come across.
Mm-hmm.
She has so much personality. Yeah. So I'm sorry, I interrupted you, which I didn't mean to do.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. I like to hear your responses to it. Anyway, they are drawn to each other's wit and intelligence and spark.
And from Shakespeare, one of the things he does, I guess, to make ends meet, is he works as a part-time bookseller when he's not writing plays. Mm-hmm. And he gives Emilia a book called The City of Ladies by Christine de Pizan, which mm-hmm. I know about because I'm a historian and I've done a lot of work with women's history. Uh-huh. But I'm not sure all my listeners do. So tell us about this book and what it means to Emilia and how she, what she makes of it. What is the book, for starters?
What is the book? The City of Ladies is an allegory, a defense of women against the tax made on them by men. Christine de Pizan wrote at the court, wrote at the French court, and there were a number of books being published then in Italy, France, England, which attacked women. I think it was started by the Romance of the Rose. Jean de Meung, who wrote the Romance of the Rose, is very satirical and critical of women. Christine said that she was deliberately writing to defend women against these unjust attacks. So in The City of Ladies, she has herself being visited by allegorical figures, mainly Lady Reason, who tells her that she needs to get up and stop moping and get to work defending women with the powers of reason and facts. And so Christine gives a catalog of good women, you know, women who have been valorous and virtuous and all that, and makes arguments against these attacks on women. So Amelia is just drawn in, mesmerized by reading this. I think it's ironic that I have Shakespeare give the book to her, but he turns out to be a bit misogynist a little later. But anyway, Amelia is just enthralled by this book, and it stimulates her thinking so much. She already was inspired by the Duchess of Suffolk, who told her that that when a woman could indeed write a book, if God inspired her to do so. And so now here's another woman in a more secular tone saying, yes, women are worthy and women should defend women against these attacks. So this really does affect Amelia in many, many ways, her developing sense of herself, as you say, as a poet and as a thinker.
And much later, as you already mentioned this book, so I'm not giving anything away by saying it, but in 1611, she writes, in a sense, her own version of The City of mm-hmm. Ladies. And it was one of the first feminist tracts in England. But tell us some of, you know, what were some of her arguments? I don't know whether you want to go into also, you know, what drove her to write this or any of that. I mean, it's really up to you to decide how much you want the audience to hear before they read the book.
First of all, the book is ostensibly religious. It has a Latin title, Salve Deus Rex Judaeorum, which means Hail God, King of the Jews. It's, you know, I'm not a major Latin scholar by any means, I've read that it's kind of awkward Latin, but it has meaning for Amelia, and it may have a reference to her own heritage. It may it's a kind of cover, though, for what she really wants to say. It's ostensibly about the crucifixion, about Pilate's wife coming to Pilate and saying, please do not execute this man because, you know, he is God. And Amelia she expands Pilate's wife's words to include a spirited defense of Eve. And she says that Eve did not intend to do any harm by giving Adam to eat of the apple. She makes, in other words, Amelia makes biblical arguments. She says Eve only wanted to do good. And her other argument, which I think is really delightful, she says, and even if she did sin by getting Adam to eat of the tree of knowledge, what you propose to do by killing Christ is so much worse that it should cancel out the whole other sin. It should cancel Eve's sin out altogether. And so, therefore, women should have their equality, because women did not commit as evil a sin as you have, as men have. So she turns the argument cleverly on its head in such a way, and makes a strong and spirited argument for women's equality. And she said, let us have our liberty again, implying that once women had liberty and now don't. And says, why should you oppose our being your equal, talking to men? And so that's the main poem in the book. And then she includes another poem in the book called Cookham. And this is a poem about a country estate where she spent some time with Lady Cumberland, Margaret Clifford, Lady Cumberland, and her daughter, Anne Clifford. And she may have been a lady-in-waiting. She may have been hired to teach music to Lady Anne, who was only in her early teens at the time. And so she says in the poem that she promised Lady Cumberland that she would write a description of that place because they had loved it so much and they hated to leave it. So she writes a description of Cookham, and she tells a story about how on the day they had to leave that she and Lady Anne, the young girl, go to a great oak tree on the property, and Anne kisses the tree, and then Amelia kisses the tree where Anne had right after her. And so I put that scene in the book. I thought it was really a charming scene and shows so much about Amelia and her connection to Lady Cumberland and her daughter.
It is a charming scene. So it's interesting. So these two things don't seem to have much to do with each other, but they were published together, I guess, because she had written them.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They were published together. I think the connection is Lady Cumberland, because there's a dedication to Lady Cumberland in the book, as well as the Cookham poem being specifically written for Lady Cumberland. And it was the first country house poem in English. Ben Jonson also gets the credit for having written the first country house poem in English, Penshurst, and that was published in 1616. And Amelia's predates it, since it was published in 1611. So anyway, a little more about the connection. I just wanted to say that Amelia includes in that book 9 dedications to 9 women who are most of them connected to one another. All of them are titled. There's the Queen, Queen Anne, and her daughter, Princess Elizabeth, and then another relative of the King, Lady Arbella Stuart, who was known for being a learned lady. And then the others, Lady Cumberland and her daughter, and Susan Lady Kent, who had been Amelia's mentor when she was young, and then a couple of others. Lucy Countess of Bedford is a niece by marriage of Lady Cumberland, and they were all like a tight group there at court of learned ladies, and they surrounded Mary Sidney, who was the Countess of Pembroke, who was Sir Philip Sidney's sister, and she translated she finished his translations of the Psalms that were left unfinished at his death, and then she went on and wrote plays, and which were not performed, but they were. She wrote an Anthony and Cleopatra play, which was what they call a closet drama, meaning it was meant to be read, not performed. And she was known as the most prominent literary woman of her time.
Ah, so that's another way in which it's a celebration of women. It's celebrating these 9 mm-hmm. women at court.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And then she does another, it's like she tries to include as many women as she can, because then she writes another one too, all virtuous ladies in general. And then let me not leave anybody out. And then she writes another one to the virtuous reader.
So it sounds like those acknowledgement sections in books, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And anybody I may have forgotten, please don't take it
anybody
firstly.
I may have forgotten, that's right. You're included too. And see, this is unique because Amelia was the first woman to seek patronage as a man would, as a male poet would, like Shakespeare or Ben Jonson or another one. You know, by dedicating her book to a well-to-do person, it was really like applying for a foundation grant. Is today, you know, you try to get noticed and funded by someone who can give you their patronage.
So you have your own interpretation of whether Amelia was, in fact, Shakespeare's Dark Lady, and I don't know mm-hmm. that we want to give that part away, but you have said online that you think there might be a connection between the Dark Lady sonnets, and or at least you can imagine a connection between the Dark Lady mm-hmm. sonnets and this book of Amelia's. Did you want to talk about that part at all?
Yeah, and first of all, I have no proof that Amelia is the Dark Lady of the sonnets. It's just speculation. It's argued by A.L. Rouse and a number of others. I think the idea is coming to be a little more accepted now. For a long time, English literature people and women's studies people didn't want to even consider it, largely because I think it took away emphasis on Amelia as a poet in her own right, you know, just connecting her to Shakespeare. And also, Rouse was a little bit full of himself and didn't say very good things about English literature people. They didn't know how to do history. They were totally wrong about everything. He was the only one who knew what was really had happened. And so a little bit of that was, I think, a bit irksome to some of them. But anyway, whether or not Amelia was the Dark Lady, in my book she is. And I I don't have any proof, but I like the idea that she might have been. And so my connection was that she was spurred to write her book when she reads Shakespeare's sonnets and reads some of the really, really negative things that he says about the dark woman in his sonnets.
Yeah, I mean, he really doesn't portray the dark lady very well, to the point where some people have speculated that it's really a man that he's writing to.
That was, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, I was done, yes.
That was Rouse's theory that the sonnets tell a story of a love triangle between Shakespeare, his patron, the Earl of Southampton, and the dark lady. And his story is that Shakespeare really loved in a kind of platonic way the young man, and the Earl of Southampton was only 18 when Shakespeare met him, but he was already very learned, and he patronized poets, and so Shakespeare dedicated his first two published poems to Southampton and wrote these very, very graceful, lovely dedications to him. So Ralph speculated that the young man of the sonnet is the Earl of Southampton, and that Amelia came between Shakespeare and his patron, and that Shakespeare has this sort of love-hate relationship with her. So I'm kind of putting that in, except that I'm not seeing Southampton as this almost paragon of virtue that Ralph saw him as, and I'm not seeing Amelia as this degraded and no better than she should be person that Ralph sees her as. You know, Ralph is kind of back and forth about Amelia. He, on one hand, he says she's the best woman poet of her age, but that's not saying much, he says. And then he says she's no better than she should be, and she's a bad lot and things like that. So I wanted to tell her story from her point of view. So anyway, I'm imagining that she was triggered to write her poems, write her book by the negative portrayal of the woman in the sonnets.
So what would you like readers to take away from Dark Lady?
How women's lives are both different and the same from the age, the Elizabethan age. How far we've come and yet how far we still have to go, because misogyny is still very alive among us. And more, I'd just like people to have an experience of what it's like to have lived in that time as much as I could evoke it as a woman, and how it was to be alive in such an exciting and frightening and dangerous and yet glorious time.
I have to tell people, you do a wonderful job with that. One of the tests of a historical novel is if you can get all of the details in there without them overwhelming the story, and you definitely do a great job with that. I was going to ask you more about your research, but we're running out of time, so we'll leave it for
the next interview.
But yes, it's really a lovely look at Elizabethan England in all its range, because, you know, we tend to think of Gloriana and the magnificent past, but it was often dirty and unfortunate and, you know, poverty ridden and goodness knows what else. And all of that is hinted at as well. So what are you working on now? Do you have another novel underway?
Well, my wife and I, Libby Ware, have just finished writing a mystery novel called Murder at the Estate Sale, which is a bibliomystery. It's about two booksellers who discover an ancient manuscript and try to solve a murder. We hope that it can become the first of a series. It involves Simon Forman, the astrologer, and a book by him that they are searching for.
Ah, I love book mysteries. I'm definitely going to look for that.
So good. Yeah, it's a bibliomystery. You know, a book, a mystery about a book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right up my alley. So thank you so much for sharing your time with us. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I really enjoyed talking with you.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I'm C.P. Leslie, and today I've been talking with Charlene Ball about Dark Lady, a novel of Amelia Bassano Lanier. You can find out more about her at http://charleneball.com. That's one word, Charlene Ball. Like us on Facebook, search for NB Historical Fiction, and follow us on Twitter at newbookshistfic. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can also find out more about me, my website, and my books at blog.cplesley.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about new books in historical fiction.